Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
This is John Paul.
And this is your X Tuesday episode for this week, first week of March 2021. And we're going to be talking about Powers of X number 4. So, or Powers of 10, I guess. I always call it Powers of X, but yeah, I think it's supposed to be Powers of 10. I don't want to say this issue was a letdown by any stretch, but I feel like it only exists for one purpose, and that's kind of to give us the beginnings of the mutant nation, and by that I mean, geographically, the physical nation, that being Krakoa, it's hard to kind of top the emotional beats that we got in House of X 3 and House of X 4 with so many of the beloved mutants dying and sacrificing and, you know, taking out the mother mold. So this one feels like a little bit of a step back, but again, they can't all be peaks because then there are no peaks. You got to have, down issues as well, where things sort of calm down, transitional issues. So any thoughts about that, John Paul?
It's kind of hard to top the last two issues, but there's very important stuff in here. And I know that it follows through the rest of the Jonathan Hickman era.
Yeah, and an interesting cover as well. We've got Professor X with his fishbowl helmet on, and then just a bunch of heads of different mutants, Beast, Archangel, the Cuckoos, Cyclops. So I don't know if that's a reference to the library, the database we'll talk about in a second. But we open up to a quote from Professor X: "I fear our needs will far outlast our desires. We have made many hard choices ahead of us." So that's an interesting concept. He's thinking that the mutants' needs are going to outlast what they actually want. That, I mean, I don't know about that. I mean, are they trying to say, well, mutants are so used to getting the shaft that they don't dare dream and even have desires, but if you bring them together as a nation, they're going to need a lot, so it's going to be more than they dare to dream for? I don't know. Many hard choices ahead of us. I mean, if that's the case, if your needs outweigh your desires, you will have hard choices. Like, what if the needs outweigh what you can actually acquire? You know, you've got to make sacrifices, and you will have tough choices. So any insight into that, knowing what you know about the future of the run?
Well, I mean, kind of got to get into the story a little bit to what I think he's referring to. But, you know, it's not going to spoil it too much. Basically, I think it's like, if they had the choice, they wouldn't align themselves with such people like Sinister.
I gotcha. Yeah, so the fact that they need to go to somebody like Sinister, the fact that Moira and Professor X have to go to Magneto, for that matter. It's what right. needs to be done based on the timelines and the lives that Moira has led, as opposed to, you know, they wouldn't normally choose necessarily to align themselves with those types of people. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense thinking at it from that perspective. Next page is credits. We have Jonathan Hickman as the writer, R.B. Silva as the artist, Marte Garcia handles the colors, and Clayton Cowell is doing the letters. First page of the story, it's X-Zero, the X-Men Year One. And it's another island. This time it's Bar Sinister, which is Mr. Sinister's island. We know him as a classic X-Men villain. First showed up in the late 80s, early 90s, all about manipulating genes and whatnot. And it's interesting. Over the years, his characterization has sort of changed a little bit, where now he's almost like this dandy or this fop character. Into fashion and all kinds of stuff. And it's so interesting the way they've done it. It's been done in such a way that you can go back and read his earlier appearances and nothing is contradicted. But I do feel like when he was first introduced, this wasn't, you know, this idea of him being sort of a dandy wasn't part of who he was, wasn't at least purposefully a part of his characterization. So it goes to show the talent of the writers that are bringing that in and making it work. I think he was supposed to be very much a villain that you feared. You know, he had this sense of menace. And while he's still very dangerous, I think portraying him as this sort of fanciful, you know, kind of fruity character is fun and interesting, and it lacks that sort of menace. He's still dangerous, but he's not scary, you know, the way he might have been considered characterized in the beginning. So on this island, Bar Sinister, which I also do want to, this is a third island we've seen, right? So we've got Krakoa, the island, Island M, and now here we are with another island, Bar Sinister. And Professor X and Magneto kind of make landfall. They're making their way in. They want to talk to Mr. Sinister. And again, with the whole idea of manipulating genetics and DNA, he's got a whole slew of Mr. Sinisters that are clones of him. And they're all sort of independent of each other. They all have, you know, little quirks. But he doesn't lack for an army or, you know, for servants or what have you, because he can and has cloned himself so many times. So it's not too long after they land on the island that Professor X and Magneto are stopped by one of these mutants. It says, one of these Mr. Sinisters says, "State your business," and mentions Magneto's cape. Like, oh, you're wearing a cape. How perfect. And he's guessing he doesn't have an appointment because whoever wears a cape doesn't ever have an appointment. And Professor X confirms, yeah, we don't have an appointment. It's important that we see Nathaniel Essex, which is Mr. Sinister's true identity. So this guard takes his helmet off, and yeah, indeed it is confirmed. It's a clone of Mr. Sinister. He's like, wait, which one? Which Nathaniel Essex? There's so many of us, right? They're all clones. And Magneto says, we'll settle for the one in charge. Oh, the one in charge. Well, aren't you something? Yes. Your outfit is ridiculous, but you do have an air about you. There's no denying that. And then he looks at Professor X and says, you, friend, though, you just won't do. This won't play well at court. You know, the sad little man in a suit, stuck in his little hover chair. He's like passive aggressively making fun of the way Professor X looks. Magneto, that's enough for Magneto. He's like, I don't have time for this. You know, he doesn't suffer fools. And so he kind of throws the guy back, and Professor X trying to calm him down. Hey, we need this guy. It's like, no, Charles, this man needs to decide if he wants to escort us inside or suffer the consequences, basically. So we're told 2 minutes later, the guy has apparently made his decision relatively quickly. He's ushered these two inside, Magneto and Xavier, and they do indeed see the Nathaniel Ethics that's in charge. And Professor X starts to say, hey, thanks for seeing us. We've come to, he's like, no, stop. Before either of you says another word, I want to make one thing perfectly clear. I love that cape. Amazing. Why do I not have a cape? How do I not have a cape? And kind of the major domo version of Mr. Sinister here. You want to talk about twirling a mustache. He literally has a handlebar mustache. And he says, yeah, sir, that's an outrage. Honestly, I've always thought you should wear one. Really? Why didn't you say anything? Oh, well, it slipped my mind. The Mr. Sinister in charge, execute this man. And they immediately tear him limb from limb, chomp, chomp, chomp. So then Mr. Sinister, okay, now to business. How can I help you? And Professor X says, well, you know, actually, we're hoping that we can help one another. We know all about your endeavors with genetics. And we know that you're, well, actually, before that, even Mr. Sinister rather is like, whoa, wait, how do you know about that? And I love the response. Professor X says, oh, we have our way. Those ways, of course, being the fact that Moira has already lived these timelines, right? And she knows all about Mr. Sinister and in the past when the X-Men have fought him, and how he's trying to compile this library of DNA from all the superpowered beings all across the planet. And Mr. Sinister doesn't think about it too deeply. He's like, oh, yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I do good work. So, of course, people are going to start to know about it. About my abilities. And then Magneto does bring up the library. Yeah, we know you're building this library. You're attempting to catalog the world's DNA. And Mr. Sinister thinks that he's being disparaging. He's like, oh, don't judge me. You're not going to shame me for changing who I am. Professor X, no, you misunderstand me. We're not trying to shame you. We're suggesting a slight deviation of focus. We want you to continue your broad indexing if you want, but we want you to prioritize mutant DNA, and we want to make sure that it's safe and secure and redundant. And we'll even help by providing you samples of those that you're having trouble getting, including ourselves. So right away, when I read this, immediately I started thinking, okay, with the ability to clone people that Mr. Sinister has, and with a library, an index of all the mutants' DNA, that could be the way that no matter who dies, where, or when, if you're a mutant, that they can always bring you back, which would technically be a clone, but I imagine with some of Krakoa going on and the organicness of that, it would basically be a copy with all the memories and not just a clone that, like Mr. Sinister's clones, are individual and have different quirks and personality traits or whatever. So Mr. Sinister hearing this says, well, I'm not sure even a serf would comprehend the point of collecting is found in the value of one's collection. So explain to me why I would take such a special interest in the mutant gene, right? Like, why are you asking me to prioritize mutant genes? And Magneto says, well, I've seen the future, and this cause, the cause of mutantdom, is yours. And Mr. Sinister is like, yeah, I don't think so. I've played around with the X gene, and I even inserted it into my superior genetic structure. And let me tell you, I didn't like the results. So I'm not going to really tolerate any. And then blam, he gets his head blown off by another Mr. Sinister who says, I will. And we find out this is the Mr. Sinister that actually has the mutant gene. He says, hey, it's me, the Sinister with the mutant gene. And if you must know, my mutant power is overthrowing tyrants and being absolutely fabulous. And Magneto's like, all right, this guy's nuts. But what he says is, yeah, I can see that. And so this Mr. Sinister, who seems even more kind of fanciful than the previous one's, like, great. So we're in this together. I love the ambition. I love every bit of it. So tell me, partners, what's next for our sinful secret confederacy? And Professor X is smart enough to know that you can't just say, okay, do this for us, Mr. Sinister, and expect him to turn it over and not have any negative repercussions. So he does plant kind of a suggestion in Mr. Sinister's mind, says, okay, first you got to do the work, and then I need you to forget why you're doing it, who you're doing it for, and that we were even ever here and asked of this until the day I tell you to remember, where you know that you actually need to know. So to your point earlier, Jonathan, John Paul, this is not good in my mind. I get why it's necessary, but Mr. Sinister is not somebody in my mind that you want to have to make a deal with, because he's just inherently not trustworthy. So I don't know, just my thought.
And we see in the timelines from Moira's past lives that he wasn't trustworthy before. He created the Chimeras to betray them. So no, yeah, it's not a good idea, but it's one of necessity.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So on the next page, we get a couple of text pages here, and I'm just going to go through them real quick. It's the Red Diamond, which is all the best news and gossip from Bar Sinister. So apparently this is just some rumors that are floating around Bar Sinister, basically. And I don't even know, how do you have gossip amongst clones who are all basically the same people? They're not gossiping about the other clones. They're gossiping about other things in the mutant world. And you can go through them if you want. And some of them are obvious what they're referring to, others not so. So there's, I think, 10 secrets here, sinister secrets. And so you go through, and they're just little blurbs like, oh, one of the secrets is he's trying to pretend that no one noticed he was wearing red shoes. But this truly sinister isn't fooling anyone. So, okay, what does that mean? And then speaking of fashion on the next one, the third one's pretty obvious. It says years ago, a deceased redhead pretender made a pact with the devil. So that's clearly Madeline Pryor. Like, why these are in here, though, I'm just not sure. There is one that I did want to mention, though. Let me see as I scan through. For years, the fittest of all mutants, this is number 8. For years, the fittest of all mutants has routinely surrounded himself with a particular numbered entourage. These hangers-on stick around for a while until they're eventually replaced with newer, more exciting members. What most people don't know is that if the original members returned, these pretenders would be dropped so fast their heads would spin. Clearly talking about Apocalypse and the Four Horsemen. But again, I'm left to wonder, but why? Like, why are these secrets here? Is it Hickman planting future storylines for Mr. Sinister? Or is it just to show Mr. Sinister loves to gossip? I don't know. So this is one of those cases where you definitely can skip the text probably. I just don't see that it has much relevance unless you know something I don't, John Paul.
Well, it's funny that you spoke about Sinister Secret number 8, because that has been revealed already.
Yeah, not a big surprise. So as we move on, we also we move forward in time. It's now X to the 1, the X-Men months ago. And this is where we see Professor X and Cypher first going to Krakoa. And Professor X is basically introducing Cypher to the island. And, you know, Cypher has his he kind of has his reservations. He's like, oh, secret islands where mutants come to die. Fantastic. Professor X is like, you know, is it wrong to expect more than sarcasm from someone whose mutant power is understanding and deciphering the nuance of language? Cypher's like, oh, yeah, I guess so. And Professor X basically tells them, hey, there's more to Krakoa than you think, right? The days of Krakoa just being our adversary are past. And it took some effort, but I finally came to an understanding with the island, and I was even able to make a telepathic connection. And the relationship between the mutant and the island and mutant man has grown. So, you know, I want you to meet the island. And the island is basically speaking through this giant tree. That's kind of the focus of the island. And we know that, you know, Doug Ramsey can speak any language. And so Professor X is communicating telepathically, and the tree is answering vocally, but it takes a little bit. It takes a few answers, and because this is a whole entire new language for Cypher, and he's saying, well, there's no fricatives, and it makes sense, but there's layering, it's dense, and, you know, ask him something like how he's feeling, because it takes more than just, you know, a few words for Cypher to sort of get what he's saying. And so Professor X asks how he's feeling, and he says, oh, yeah, he says he feels sad. And Cypher's like, okay, let me guess. This telepathic conversation you're having, it's a lot closer to sharing feelings than actual language, right? Like, you're not actually talking. It's saying, like, Xavier friend, island friend, friends happy, friends many years, that kind of thing, right? And Professor X is like, well, are you saying that he said – he didn't say he was sad. Krakoa is not sad. And Cypher's like, well, it's he's definitely unhappy, but it's more complicated and deeper than just saying he's sad. And Professor X is like, and he probably regrets asking this question. He's like, so what did he say? And Cypher just goes off. He's like, well, I'm sure I missed some of it, but what he said was, we are Okara, the one land, ancient before that word even existed. But not yet old in the way that they were old. And the twilight sword of the enemy tore the world asunder, and what was one land, became two. And now, instead of having the one land, you had Arako and Krakoa. And from the chasm between the two came the enemy that poured into the world, whatever wicked place that was. And if it was not for the man who was not a man, the very first mutant who we know as Apocalypse, the warrior god in blue, the world would have fallen. And using all his mighty powers, Apocalypse stood in the gap. And he pushed Arako through the chasm and set his four to sentinel that land and sealed the chasm shut. So these are his, you know, first four horsemen, and sealed the land shut, never to be opened again. And it was a thing that had to happen. But because of that, Krakoa remains alone, a half, not a whole. Only Arako got pushed through the chasm. Krakoa stayed behind, and now it's forever alone and forever incomplete, or something like that, says Cypher. So really interesting here, and having read the beginning of Ten of Swords, I know that this is all about Ten. This is what Ten of Swords is all about. Arako, and we even see Apocalypse holding swords here, and so this is all explored in that story, if I'm not mistaken. I've only read the first two parts, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. Is that right, John Paul?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
it goes pretty far in depth, and for a couple of issues, a little repetitive on the story, but yeah, they get more into it in Ten of Swords for sure, for sure.
Yeah, and we'll be covering that obviously when we get to it. So again, I feel like Professor X probably, well, that's more information than I needed, but that's more than the island just saying, yeah, I'm sad. We're getting some reasons behind that. So later, Professor X is ready to leave, but he's leaving Cypher behind, saying, you know, I was hoping you wouldn't mind spending some time here on your own. And Cypher's like, oh, you got some plans, huh? All right, well, I'm interested. And Professor says, well, it's better if I show you than just tell you. So he shares what's in his mind. And Doug's blown away, almost left speechless for a moment, and then says, well, that's ambitious. And Professor X is like, well, whatever's worth doing is usually ambitious. How long do you think it will take? And so Cypher thinks about it for a little bit. He goes, well, we have phonology, we have syntax, have to build an interface. The ecosystem's unknown, so that'll be tricky. It's like, I don't know, maybe months, maybe a year. I'm terrible at this. I can't really estimate, but how's that sound? Professor X says, well, it sounds like you got a lot of work ahead of you. Best get to it. And he tosses him a bag of clothes and gear. And on the next page, we see current Krakoan systems. So this is what Doug is doing. This is what Professor X showed him. And we know the island is a place where mutants can go. And we know there's a bunch of systems, transportation systems. And we know there's a Krakoan language that he built because the inherent language of the island that he just learned, he's the only one that can understand it. Not even Professor X telepathically can understand it. You know, clearly he got the message that the island was sad, but it was so much more than that. So in this graphic, we're shown the interfaces built by Doug Ramsey, Cypher, a translation program so that other mutants can interact with the island without needing to go to Cypher to act as a go-between. So you don't need Cypher to translate. So there's a transit monitoring system, which is run by Sage. There's a defense observation system run by Black Tom Cassidy. There are secondary and external systems, which are run by Trinary. And then there's an overwatch and a data analysis section that's run by Beast. And there is a note that says, while there's been no actual evidence of a Krakoan skunkwork existing, there are rumors of a massive subterranean laboratory where Forge is busy building biological machines that could possibly be used to manage a mutant expansion on the island in the event that, you know, you get enough mutants there where you need more space, more room, as it were. So as we move forward, we jump to the X-Men year 1000. We've jumped over the year 100, where we saw Apocalypse and the mutants that were left on Earth steal the information they needed to find out about the origins of Nimrod. So we're skipping over that. We don't get any of that in this issue, but we do see the librarian. And remember, the Phalanx had shown up. They had tried to get the Phalanx to show up, and they have. And the First Elder is there speaking to the Phalanx, who's appeared on Earth, saying, I'm the First Elder, and this is my seer self, which is an orb floating around, basically the machine version of this elder. And he says, we're ready for conversion. We hope for ascension. And the Phalanx is like, well, we don't really care about hope. Will you ascend? And the elder says, well, we have to try, don't we? Isn't that what comes next? Isn't that the next step in evolution? The idea of your great union existing just beyond our reach is something we can't tolerate. So do it. So there's some arrogance there from this elder saying, well, we are whatever we are here, but there are beings greater than us. That's not okay. The next step for us is to be, you know, part of that. So do it. Assimilate us, ascend us, whatever you need to do. And so the Phalanx reaches out, but instead of grabbing the elder, it grabs the elder's seer self. It grabs the elder's the mechanical version of the elder. And basically absorbs it into itself. And the rest of this seers, the librarian, even Nimrod himself are just kind of standing there staring at the Phalanx going, okay, well, am I in there anywhere? Have you assimilated me? And the Phalanx says, anywhere there in we am? Like, okay, if that's so, then you're going to know the sequence that I thought of. Like, if you have assimilated my knowledge, because I know the sequence, And between us, we're the only two that know the sequence. And so he's basically saying, I know a password, and my mechanical self knew the password. You supposedly have absorbed my mechanical self, so you know the password too. And so sure enough, the Phalanx says, there was a city on the mountain, and behind it, the sun shone brightly, and then too brightly as it expanded to consume the city, the mountain, the world. And the seer says, so it worked. You know, I've been assimilated. My knowledge is in there. And the Phalanx says, yeah, it worked. And the librarian says, okay, so the question remains. And the elder's like, yeah, do we find this form of conversion acceptable? Like, are we all going to do this? And as they're thinking about it, we see the Phalanx that are there change shape. And all of a sudden, they become the same shape as the seer self, the mechanical version of the seer. They form that ball rather than the humanoid shape that they had been before. And they say, we're awaiting your response. We're awaiting your answer. And a couple of the blueskins here are like, well, wait, I don't understand what just happened. Like, why did they change shape like that? Are these blueskins, are they trying to manipulate the Phalanx? Because that's kind of what it seems like to me. But the librarian says, well, the Phalanx are the forerunners of a galactic empire. And we believe this galactic empire has, you know, control over the entirety of the known universe. And of course, the word empire isn't really accurate, because we don't believe their actions are in any way imperial. They're not just conquering for the sake of conquering. It's just the only word that conveys the scale we're talking about. You know, they just absorb knowledge in whatever way they can find it. And so they're like, well, what do they want? Well, it's not what they want. It's what they do, right? The Phalanx has the ability to integrate any machine into their collective. And after a period of time, if the intelligence that is housed in that machine is found worthy, then they will ascend the civilizations that created that intelligence, basically. So you get to be part of a greater collective. You become part of the empire. And so the other blueskin says, well, clearly we know they find us useful, which I guess is a win. But here you are, you're not celebrating at all, not one bit. And she says, well, everything always comes down to the question of cost, right? The problem isn't that this method doesn't work with biological entities. So we would all be able to transfer our knowledge into a machine, just like the seer self had that, you know, orb for the elder. But even as you are, your knowledge is absorbed, you still die, right? And again, it comes to this arrogance of what the, and especially think because it's the, you know, the eldest of them who seems so eager for this, looking for a way to sort of cheat death and, you know, ascend, you know, that word ascend, become something more than you were, trying to find a way to not die, basically. And the librarian goes on to say, so the elder made a host machine, right? This empty vessel, he copied himself into it. The Phalanx absorbed it. And we just confirmed that he was in there somewhere because they knew the password. And Nimrod says, yeah, it's forbidding, isn't it, librarian, that they want us and not you? So Nimrod, once again, even in this advanced state, twisting the knife, machines are better than biological, you know, isn't it terrible? You know, that foreboding sense that you won't live forever, but machines will. And so they say, well, so we're trying to trick them into finding a way to have them extend our biological life. And he says, no, we don't think there's any tricking them. We're just hoping we found a way around the problem. We just have to see if they find it acceptable. So the way around the problem being transfer, not just your knowledge, but your consciousness from your biological body to a machine body, and then have that machine knowledge, consciousness, what have you, absorbed into the Phalanx. So I think that's what they're referring to. And John Paul can correct me if he knows differently, but the big clue for me is why I think this is the fact that once they absorbed the elder's self seer, as he called it, that the Phalanx beings who previously looked sort of humanoid, they amalgamated together and they now look like that Self-Seer. Like clearly these Blueskins are manipulating the Phalanx in some way, which is really interesting when you think about it, because the Phalanx is supposed to be this, you know, nearly God level amount of intelligence. You wouldn't think it would be able to be tricked. And God knows if Hickman has even gotten to explore any of these crazy radical ideas of futurism here that we have 1,000 years in the future. So what do you have to add, John Paul?
Actually, you gave me some insight into this. You know, sometimes you just have to read stuff out loud to kind of get a full grasp of it, especially when it's complex ideas like this. But when you read it out loud, it's like, oh yeah, that makes more sense.
Right.
And so, yeah, you taught me.
So I'm correct in thinking Hickman hasn't gotten to exploring this.
Oh no, he has not. I mean, like, I really, this has to be at least 2 years from now. Like when he might touch on it within this year, but like, I don't see him completing this storyline until at least 2 years from now.
Yeah.
Probably maybe longer, depending on how much runway he's given.
Yeah. And the other part is that even, and this goes to that comment made by Nimrod, you know, foreboding, isn't it, librarian, that they want us and not you. Even here, 1,000 years in the future, after everything that's gone down, we still have machine and man fighting against each other. You know, like it's that never ending. And you thinking of the Phalanx as just this great giant amalgamation of knowledge in its own way as a machine. And, you know, even some of the Blueskins saying, oh, so we're trying to manipulate them. It's still the fight between man and machine. Well, not trying to manipulate them, just trying to figure out a way around them. It all comes down to the same thing. You know, is it a biological person that's at the top of the heap, or is it the machine? So I guess we'll have to see if Hickman ever gets around to telling that story. But that's basically it for the issue. We get one more page of the quote from Professor Xavier saying, I'm not afraid of what I've done, but I do fear what it will one day cost. So going back to what John Paul said earlier about the opening quote, and you know, it's our needs outweigh our desires. And the idea that you need to work with Magneto, you need to work with Mr. Sinister, and eventually you're going to pay that price. I think that's exactly what this is saying, right? Like Professor X is not afraid of the choices he had to make because they had to be made. I'm not afraid that I was forced to work with Magneto or I was forced to work with Mr. Sinister. But at some point, you know, you lay with a dog, you get fleas, right? So he does fear what it will one day cost, the fact that he is working with Magneto, or he did, you know, give this library of mutant DNA to Mr. Sinister, and to John Paul's point earlier as well about how we know in the timeline that Sinister created the Chimeras because he had access to that library of DNA. And that was a good thing until it wasn't, until he created Chimeras that purposely betrayed the mutants. So, you know, Professor X knows that these are tough choices he has to make. He's backed into a corner. He's forced to do them. But he does fear when it comes time to pay the cost for those, you know, for those choices. So then we get the next page that has the reading order, and that's it. So a pretty quick issue. Like I said, I feel like the main point of it was to tell us about Ramsey, Doug Ramsey, and him communicating with Krakoa. At first, obviously we haven't had the future stuff play out yet, like John Paul told us. But also I guess the Mr. Sinister stuff is pretty important as well. And then from Hickman's perspective, the origin of Krakoa, which plays into his Ten of Swords story, he's already laying the groundwork for that. I mean, we know he works far, far in advance. So it's a fun issue. It's definitely kind of a let's all catch our breaths after the impact of House of X 3 and 4. So I think it works well for what it is. The art's done really well, as it has been throughout the series. The color work is great as well. So I don't really have too much else to say. There's not a lot to analyze here, at least not in terms of in comparison to the last couple issues. But what do you have to add, John Paul?
I've come to realize that the artist RV Silva, the eye thing is just part of his style. The beady eye thing, that's just part of his style. So I accept it for what it is.
Yeah, there are a couple of panels where he goes with the beady eye thing. And it might just be usually it's on a smaller version of a character,
Right.
in scale, and he probably just doesn't want to go try to go through the detail and have it, not look good. So yeah, he just goes with the little orphan Annie eyes and calls it a day.
He's still a fantastic artist, though.
Oh yeah, definitely, a great artist. The other thing about this issue is the text pages. This is the first time where I felt like I'd read a text page and I was not wishing that I hadn't read it, but just feeling like I could have skipped it with those secrets. It didn't seem to be that important. The
I
one
think it's because of the format and just knowing the character of Sinister, his frivolity of speech. So, yeah, I think that's what it is.
Yeah, and I mean, it is conveyed really well, and I do like the characterization. It makes Sinister stand out as an X-Men villain much more so than he did. Because I always used to wonder, like when he first came on the scene, between him and Strife, like, why do we need both? They seem so similar, they both mess with genetics and make clones and whatever. And this really helps differentiate and makes me like Sinister a lot more. It makes him a more interesting character.
Right.
So. All right, I guess that's it for this episode, everybody. As always, we want to thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.